Thank you very much. I'm going to open it up for questions. I just want to emphasize before we start, Brian has made this point, Lonnie has made this point, that Pacifica doesn't have a coherent licensing policy for its content. Everything's right now ad hoc. And this is not an... That's not for all our content. It may be for the archives, but in terms of the use agreements for somebody who comes in, we don't have a coherent policy for all our content. It may be for the archives.
We just don't use it.
Pardon me?
It's been there. We just don't use it.
Okay. Well, then I stand corrected if I misspoke. The idea of this conversation is that we need to deal with even if we do have it, we haven't had a discussion about how it relates to our various ethics at the board level. And so this is an opening effort to do that. And to repeat, Dr. Lessig has offered to work with us to design licenses that do the things that we want to see. I imagine we're going to have different points of view on that, but let's get them out and talk about them. So I saw Rip with his hand up first, and then I'll just go around this. I'll just come around the loop this way. Go ahead, Rip. Wait, one other thing. We have about 40 minutes left, of which we have about 10 minutes for another presentation, but if we could delay, since we have an hour and a half of break during the day, if we can delay a few minutes the start of the training, maybe we can take that back by having shorter lunch period if people want to do this a little longer. It's up to us when we get there, but we're scheduled to end at 11. Go ahead.
Good morning, Ken. I've got a couple questions about how it worked at your station. The first one is, how much staff time has the station needed to use to develop this? And also, do you have the tags on the podcast for FMU?
Do we put ID3 tags into our podcast?
Yeah, or something at the beginning when they first start listening to the podcast. Do you have your own message on there?
We don't have an introductory fundraising message. We don't put that in front of our streams, in front of our archives, or in front of our podcasts. Again, we want to just have as few hurdles as possible to people listening to us online. So we don't ask people at the beginning of the stream, you know, to please contribute, because again, it's just an annoyance, and I feel like it's just going to cut down the number of online listeners we have. So no, we don't put any kind of fundraising message at the beginning, middle, or end of any of our online offerings.
Staff time?
Staff time has pretty much been about 1.5 positions. I have a full-time IT person at FMU, in terms of paid positions anyway. I have one full-time IT person who deals mostly with hardware issues, and I'm probably spending about half my time on various online activities these days. And then in addition to that, there's a volunteer IT staff of about a dozen people. But in terms of full-time paid staff, it's about 1.5 positions.
Bob? Alan.
Sorry. I should add that it's nowhere near enough. That 1.5 full-time positions doesn't come close to what we need to be doing right now. I could easily use two more full-time people with what we're doing, especially if we're going to try to set up a full-time PodSafe stream.
And then, so economically, does that work out? You're making enough money to pay for those two positions out of that?
Yeah, the station operates with more or less a balanced budget.
I have a number of questions for you, but first a very basic question for you. The presentation that you just gave, is it available on the Internet?
I made it available. I mean, I made it for you, but right. I'm happy to give it to you, of course.
Oh,
I have
yeah.
A Commons license.
Yeah, no, that'd be great. And I'd love that, actually.
Sure.
And also, is there a website that you'd recommend for us to go to continue to?
So everything about Creative Commons is at creativecommons.org. And
why don't we move the
connection? Yeah.
Sure. You had another question. Go ahead.
I had a bunch of questions for Ken Freeman, correct?
Yeah.
Your format of your radio station, music, politics, volunteer programmers, staff paid programmers, and I'll have a follow-up to question to this.
It's almost all volunteers,
all right.
24 hours a day, and it's mostly music. We intentionally do not have news programming just because it's expensive and difficult to produce, and most of our audience is in the New York area that has, at last count, 7 or 8 full-time radio news stations.
The average hour length of a show, how many hours?
3 hours.
And then you put up all 3 hours consecutively.
Yeah, we record every show. We have 3 different computers at the station that record every single show, 24 hours a day.
I think that I work on one music show. I'm generally in, and the music show is also available on a website that the people who do the music show, it's an incredibly popular show. But I understand why people go then for weeks and months back to this website and download the show because it's a music show. I don't know if you've thought about this, but any reflections on how this model might work for political talk radio? After all, it turns over more quickly, the relevance and irrelevance.
Well, you actually have a lot more freedom if you're talking about talk programming, because as soon as you have music programming in there, you have the, you know, you have the right issue, all the rights issues related to all the music that you're programming. So we don't make our archives available for download. The only programming that we make available for download are our 15 podcasts, which are mostly talk programs, but some of them are music programs where we have the rights to the music as well. So you have a lot more freedom with talk programming than you do with music programming.
And one final question, because this is an issue at our station that is being resolved, I think, constructively. But what about your programmers? Do any of your programmers have unique websites related to their shows? And have they wanted to have those? And how do those conflict with the station making their shows accessible?
We encourage our DJs to set up their own websites and their own blogs. And, yeah, a few of our programmers have done that. One of our programmers has set up his own website that's very extensive with all sorts of offerings.
Including the shows?
Yeah. We don't let our programmers set up pages with their archives. We want the archives and the streams. I mean, we let them put up links to the streams, and we encourage people to put up links to their streams. But in terms of the archives, we want that all the archive streaming to come back to our site. We do have certain rules about what they're allowed to put on any WFMU.org page. So DJs are not allowed to sell any of their products on any page that's on the WFMU.org domain. If people have items related to their show that they're trying to sell, they have to put it on their own website.
And lastly, again, I'm sorry, this is coming to fruition at KPFK. This is an issue we're resolving. It's ongoing. Do you then ask the programmers on their website when they link to your site for the download that maybe it explicitly says it's coming from WFMU? Do you ask that that be made clear on those websites?
No. And during fundraising time also, we put up a little banner ad that allows people to initiate a donation to WFMU from any other site. And we email the code for that banner out as many places as we can, and we encourage people to put it on any blog that they can get it on, any other website that they get it on. And for the most part, pledges are initiated on our own website. And the only other websites that we get any significant number of pledges initiated on are our DJs' own websites.
And if I may then, for the group, just to say, we have about 5 to 7 programmers who are way ahead of the station on this curve.
Don.
Well, thank you for both of these presentations. It really, I'm not exactly a techie, so this really raised my consciousness and understanding. I just wanted to briefly ask about attribution and how you can enforce attribution. And so, Ken, for instance, is this too far out that you were talking about other radio programs, other radio stations actually using your programming? Can you enforce an attribution like the following program is made possible through the courtesy of, and then forcing others to give the exact location and how their listeners can actually come to you? That is to say, how strongly can you enforce, even with other radio stations and with all using, enforce the promotion of WFMU and like KPFK through an imposed legally binding attribution to the source?
That's well, probably. In the context of Creative Commons licenses, every license has an explicit attribution requirement. And you get to specify what the attribution is. So you can say attribution is to be given in the following way. And so you could specify precisely that attribution to say this comes from KPFA, broadcast on blah, blah, blah. Now, in what way is it enforced? Well, technically, when someone is downloading content from a website, they're making a copy of it. Copyright law, because of its expansive, endless reach, means that every time they make a copy, they've got to have some kind of permission to make the copy. The license is the permission. The license says, here's what you've got to do in order to avoid being a copyright infringer. You've got to give attribution, or you've got to not use this for commercial work, or whatever the license says. If you don't obey the license, then you technically have infringed the copyright, unless you can claim fair use, which is a very vague and uncertain category. So in that sense, it's enforced. It's not enforced in a technical sense. Like, there's nothing we're building into the code to force people to see any attribution. But a very important principle that Creative Commons is built on is that we want to make rights visible, or we want to express rights. We don't want to use technology to enforce them, because when you use technology to enforce them, you break the opportunity for lots of people to use the material in ways that nobody ever expected. So that's the sense in which we would enforce them.
I saw Rob, then Ambrose.
I just wanted to ask Ken if you could talk a little bit about how you quantify your audience now that you're in the digital distribution, and if you could talk a little bit about the increases in audience and financial support that you've seen over time.
Well, in online radio, it's very easy to see exactly how many people are listening, and it's very easy to generate reports, so you see exactly what's going on. Much easier than it's not possible at all in FM. In FM, you're dealing on a survey-based model, which is just a sampling of a very, very small number of people, and you're extrapolating it to the general population. But with online radio, you can see exactly how many archives are getting streamed, exactly how many logons you have on a stream. It's a little bit different between live streams and archived streams than it is with podcasts, though, because with a live stream and with an archive, you can pretty safely make a presumption that if that stream or archive is running, there's probably somebody listening to it. It's true that somebody may have just turned it on and then walked away or left for the weekend or whatever. But for the most part, you can make a presumption that a stream and an archive that's streaming along has a listener. Not so with podcasts, though. I have no idea what's going on with podcasts. I can see how many podcasts get downloaded, but I have no idea how many of them actually get listened to. I suspect that a great deal of our podcasts get downloaded and never get listened to. Some people have talked about building software into podcasts such that it reports back to home base when the file actually gets opened, but that only works on a computer. That wouldn't work on an iPod, for example. So it's a little harder to know of these, you know, if I have a show that has 5,000 downloads per month, how many of those equate to actual listens? That's a big mystery to me.
Ambrose.
I'd just like to ask the professor, how does one use this creativity that's used in music, in public affairs, to help us expand our listenership? How best can we do that? Because a lot of us have a great deal of public affairs programs running from our national Democracy Now to local early morning shows and an hour public affairs shows of all kinds. How do we use what you're suggesting for those kinds of programming?
Well, I'm not sure that every kind of programming could actually use it.
But I
am sure that what the objective of a station in general should be to increase the amount of civic media in this sense that you can use. And in my view, the way to do that is to begin to recognize the creator and the community that's built around the creativity. So again, that site that I showed you, CC Mixter, which is about surfacing creative work and also surfacing the community that has contributed to that creative work, builds a sense among the community, members of the community, about why this is a project they ought to be devoting their time to. I'm sure you've all seen the Wikipedia project, which is this extraordinary online encyclopedia that's been built totally voluntarily by people around the world, tens of thousands of people making contributions. It has a staff of exactly one full-time person. It is, I think, now the fifth most frequently visited website in the world. What's very important there is that people recognize that it's a community contributing, and the licensing explicitly says you're contributing to a community, and that work gets to be used by others. It's inviting people. Again, my band Wilco, as Jeff Tweedy says, it's inviting the audience up on stage. That's the idea. Invite them on stage, right? So, one way to do this in the context of music, again, this is not a public affairs idea as much, but in music is to run these remix contests, right? So we can give you the software for free, and you run the remix contests, and over a course of 4 months, you know, you slowly show the stuff that has been contributed that's better and better, and each week it's something better and better until you have the winner. It's something that drives attention towards that type of creativity. In the context of public affairs, though, this is a point that I thought came out of what Ken was saying, was very interesting. I've been struck, as we see digital media develop, with the dearth of real useful archives to get access to our public affairs past. So, for example, think about the recent, you know, dispute raised about whether the president knew that the levies were going to give way, right? He so came on national television and said, I didn't know the levies were going to give way, and then there was released the video where there he was being told the levies are going to give way before he said that. Okay, so some people might think he was not telling the truth.
How about that?
Yeah. Okay, so, you know, remember...
Is that possible?
Yeah, so, but remember, just a couple years ago, we impeached a president for not telling the truth.
Yes,
right?
We did.
Now, imagine if accessible to everybody were all the news programs around the time when we were impeaching the president, with all of these sort of self-righteous members of Congress getting up and saying, it's the president should never lie to the American, you know, and just clip all those things together and pull them together and then match them to the stuff that was happening around Katrina, right? The point is, we have the technology to do it, and we have the will. People would love to be able to do it. We just don't have the resources. They don't exist out there. All of these television resources are kept by Vanderbilt in a way that's not accessible for this type of use. And what's necessary is that people begin to supplement the archive resources out there to make it so people can build these kinds of shows. And that's one way, I think, that, you know, public affairs programs can do it. You have an extraordinary archive of attitudes at particular times in the history, you know, just of the last 10 years. Imagine being able to selectively pull them out and tell stories, wrapping them together. And imagine inviting your audience to do it. And when you invite your audience to do it, then the great ones you show, right? Al Gore's new television station, Current TV, gets 30% of their programming from their audience. They invite their audience to submit programs, and what they use, they pay for. But they get 30% of their programming from their audience. And they're now, it's extraordinary explosion around the world. They have some 40 million households that they're going to right now. But that's a model, right, for your stuff, too. You tell us news stories. You begin to give it to them, and then stuff that you like, you use, and the other stuff you maybe just make available.
I want to add one other thing. When Sound Posse makes its stuff available, we do one-hour talks typically. There's a guy in New York named Andre who takes our stuff and that of others and puts it behind music. He's a composer. He does hip-hop stuff. And he puts hip-hop beats, and he takes the most cogent several minutes of a talk. He's done this with Amy Goodman's stuff, George Galloway, Mumia Abu-Jamal, other people. He puts it to beats, and instead of a one-hour lecture, you get a five-minute hip-hop piece with mind-blowing politics that a very different sector is going to listen to. And he makes these as CDs, and you know, I listen to it as music, but it's as politically deep as anything. So imagine we ourselves, a five-minute, most mind-blowing clip put to music, and we could do remix context to have musicians put our public affairs content to music and then package those CDs as FunDrive premiums made by our audience that kids will listen to in a way they'll never listen to a one-hour public affairs show. Bob and then Lisa.
Professor Lessig, I really appreciate the whole Creative Commons license. I think it's made a great contribution. And I want to ask you about the relationship of that to some of the more traditional intellectual property, particularly for Pacifica producers. When Dave Adelson gave us some guide questions for today,
That was Lisa's report. We collaborated a little.
Okay, Dave and Lisa. One of the questions that I want to ask you about, Professor Lessig, was about a scenario, an example of a licensing scenario that could use some of the principles that you've described. And it says, let any producer develop additional distribution for their programming in the way that Democracy Now! Has without having to seek permission from Pacifica, since the permissions and terms are built into the licensing. So my question is, having spoken to a lawyer recently about this, it's my understanding that the producer, and also keep in mind that 90%+ of the producers at Pacifica are unpaid, the producers already have that right. They don't have to ask permission from Pacifica for the right to distribute it to other radio stations. And, in fact, that's a very common practice. It's gone on for many years. Some of them distribute it for free. Some of them negotiate payments with other radio stations. So how does that interact here when the question really isn't that Pacifica has the right to restrict in the first place the distribution of the work, the creative work of its own producers, but yet both Pacifica and I would imagine every producer share an interest in getting the broadest possible distribution of the work, but with the option that that can come back to the financial benefit of the creator if that person wants to do it that way.
Yeah, I didn't have anything to do with drafting that range of questions, and I don't actually know exactly what the relationships are typically between producers and their station around across the full range of radio. Obviously, in my view, it's a great thing if the producer is allowed to retain rights over the creative work that he or she has produced. I think that's the idea of copyright. Many organizations, though, force especially in a commercial relationship, force the creator to give up their rights to the corporation. That's the work for hire idea. And that, you know, I think means that it's the corporation that gets to choose. So obviously you're telling me that Pacifica still has the traditional and I think better relationship. That's great. The key that Creative Commons is trying to enable, though, is that you make it more automatic whatever rights need to be cleared, right? So you want to make it so it's easy for people to know what they can do without worrying about clicking back and asking permission, because you want somebody in the Ukraine to be able to do something without feeling embarrassed they're going to have to send an email message in English that tries to explain what they want to do exactly, right? So that's the infrastructure we're trying to do. So you pick the places where permission is actually necessary and then ask, is there a way to make more automatic that permission? And I don't think it's possible in all cases. Absolutely. Like, you know, if it's going to be a commercial use by CBS of some particular kind, you want CBS to have to come back to you and negotiate with you, because I hope you'll force them to pay you a lot of money for the thing that you want them to use. But in a bunch of other contexts, our point is we do understand what the permissions ought to be, and we ought to just make it simpler for those to be implemented.
It's also the case that at some stations people have been told they cannot do certain things with content. I mean, that's been an open question. And a previous executive director asserted that Pacifica had exclusive distribution rights over volunteer-produced content. So we need to be clear about it, and these licenses would clarify those relationships permanently, including our own distribution rights, because notwithstanding what Brian just said about a coherent license policy, he's definitely also told us that some of the content that went in there, we still are not clear on what rights we have of distribution on that stuff. And so establishing not just one license, but a series of licenses, because we have different kinds of content. We have volunteer-produced content, we have stuff we air from outside people, and we have paid work-for-hire content, and we need to decide what we're doing on that front. Ray?
Can I just add one quick sentence on that, because Ken Freeman made a statement.
Friedman,
I'm sorry. that I think was something to the effect of, we don't let our programmers set up archives of their shows on their own websites. And that's something that well, I don't know about other stations. At WBAI, there are no restrictions. And again, I think this would fall in, I'm not an expert on the law, but I think that would fall under the legal right of the producer of the program to determine that. And it's really not up to the station, unless the person negotiates with the station to say, that we can restrict your ability to use a copy of the show for your own purposes, which could include making money.
But regardless of what the rights are, if the station program director or general manager says, if you do this, you're off the air, that's a functional veto on it. And so we as a board should decide on our, what is our policy on that? I probably disagree with some people here on that, but we have to come to a clear decision, because even if we do have a coherent policy on licensing, it's certainly a case, for example, that on archiving, every station has made different decisions right now about how they're going to do this. And I had Ray, and then I'll come back to Don. And we're coming up.
Can I just address that? We do allow our programmers to build blogs or websites based around the archives or the podcasts. I mean, the point is that we provide these services for our programmers. We archive every single show. We podcast every single show that we legally feel that we have the right to podcast. So there's no need for our programmers to go out and do it on their own. The reason why I think it's a really bad idea to allow programmers to set up pages that provide links to archives is just technically it's a bad idea, because sometimes archives get corrupted, sometimes archives have errors in them, and our whole archive system is driven by a database. You don't want dual databases. You don't want two databases that are attempting to do the same thing. I think it's self-evident that that's a bad idea. And if an archive goes bad, we don't want to have to manually fix it on one page and then have the database deal with the problem on the station-wide database. So we don't want our programmers to podcast their own material, but we encourage them to set up a blog based around their podcast to provide all, you know, more data about what's in the podcast. We're all for that. We just don't want to duplicate our efforts, and we want all of our archiving and podcasting efforts to be managed by one central database, just because it's a lot better. It's a much better way to do it that way.
Right.
We have our website is 20,000 pages now,
okay.
And it's managed by a database, and it has to be managed by a database. If you had people hand coding even 1,000 of those 20,000 pages, it would be a disaster.
Ray, before you, Sarv had had his hand up for a while, so I'll go Sarv, Ray, and Marianne. I would like to ask a question, so if we could hurry so that we have time. We have 15 minutes left in this section, unless we can take 10 minutes more at the end.
Well, thank you, Mr. Lessig, and thank you, Ken. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm just going to go there to the simple premise. You are familiar with WBI's mission. That's where your station, you said you knew your station grew out of that. I don't know what the mission of your radio station is, but the mission of our network is to bring ideas that are not necessarily geared towards maximizing the number of audience or the economic benefit to the network. We put on air sometimes those programs we know, and we intentionally put it on the air, that they are important and we got to put it out there. So given that kind of a mission, I don't know what your mission is. Could you distinguish the mission between Pacifica and your own mission of your station?
It's a slightly different mission. I mean, our mission is not clearly articulated towards social justice the way I understand Pacifica's mission is. Our mission is also to expose and explore culture, music, and ideas that are not readily available, and we've specified even on other alternative outlets. So we're trying to be an alternative to the alternatives. And our mission, I don't think, is anywhere near as specific as Pacifica's is. But I think there is a certain similarity. It's just a very, very different approach that we're taking. While we don't have a whole lot of overt public affairs, news, and political programming, there is a great deal of news, public affairs, and politics in our programming, but a lot of it is implicit in the music. It's implicit in the DJ's attitudes. We give people a three-hour tablet to create radio, and a lot of the politics comes across within that three-hour block. It's just not done in the same way that it's done on Pacifica.
Ray?
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for both presentations. Well, it's really a non-technical question. From the user's point of view, maybe I'm showing my age, but I relate to that box called a radio much more than the technology that you're describing. How do you resolve the tension between what I'm assuming is still a majority of listeners, people listening to the radio, and encouraging them somehow to use that technology? Or do you just address them as two separate publics?
Well, I'm not quite sure I understand the question.
You have people who don't use digital devices to listen to audio. Do you see them as distinct audiences, or do you think of them as, is that correct?
And how do you go about bringing them around?
We don't try to actively bring people around to listening online. We do get a lot of requests from people asking for help. So we spend a lot of effort basically providing customer support. People who just bought a computer who don't know how to listen online. So we provide support to those people via email and telephone to help them. We finally passed the point where over 50% of our listeners are listening online, but most of those online listeners also occasionally listen on the radio. The number of people who we have listening exclusively on the radio is just getting smaller and smaller every year. I do see that as a separate segment of our audience. It's a little scary to me how fast it's dropping. It's dropping by about 4 to 5% a year at this point. The number of people who listen only to an FM signal is quickly...
I actually think this is an opportunity for public radio because I don't think you're going to change what 60-year-old people or 70-year-old people do, right? But I would think one of the most important demographics for public radio are kids between the age of 15 and 25 because they're not listening to public radio as much as you want them to, right? Well, imagine you start enabling them to use the materials to do these digital, you know, media, civic media projects. In fact, you start working with schools and you say to schools, look, here's the archives, here are the projects your kids can do. If this becomes good, we'll play these things on the radio station. What we know from watching kids using digital technology is you don't need to do anything more than give them the opportunity, and then it becomes the coolest thing in the world for them to do. There have been amazing studies by the Annenberg Center in L.A. schools, in the worst of L.A. schools. You know, the kids who can, you know, very poor English skills, who have very difficult times, you know, doing the ordinary things that we think of schools is designed to do, teaching them to read and write. But they create these media programs where these kids who, you know, otherwise you can't keep them in school during the ordinary time, spend 18 hours a day, you know, there all the time trying to perfect their music video about drugs or music video about guns in their neighborhood or music video about what it is to be 15 and from a country like El Salvador, right? This becomes the way that they want to speak. And you just invite them and give them the opportunity to do it, they'll show you the passion. And if you can begin to translate that passion into support for public radio, you know, instead of support for Warner Music, that would be really progressive, right? So this, I agree that some people aren't going to change, but the people who are most likely to use this type of expression are exactly the people I would think you want to include.
And I just want to say, people ask the same question about email. And many people came to use it when it became necessary. Email, the same argument. Mary, I just said that question about use and the differences of use in different communities was asked about email. And when email became a necessary communication technology, they used it. Ditto when FM radio was only available on FM radio and nobody had transmitters. When there was something there they needed, they went. Mary, then Lisa... Patty, and I would still like to get a comment.
I have a couple of questions for you, Ken Friedman. One question is, you say that the numbers are dropping of people who are listening over the air.
People who listen exclusively over the air.
Yeah, I'm wondering how do you know that? And also, Dr. Lessig, you mentioned people are not listening to radio. I know that the Arbitron studies say this, but I also know that the Arbitron studies are skewed with relation to certain audiences, especially the kind that we might be looking for. So it's not certain to me, if they don't listen to NPR, that they're not listening to all kinds of other things like low-power radio or what. I'm wondering how you know that. And my second question is, you mentioned that you don't have downloading of your archives. I don't know how you, I'm wondering how you prevent that. Anybody can download anything they want. If they hear it, if it goes in digitally anywhere, they can do it.
Well,
so those are my two questions. How do you stop people from downloading whatever is either streamed or archived? And then the first question about the
Okay, well, your second
audio.
Question first. I mean, it's true that you can put software on your computer that'll capture anything that's going through your sound card, but it was also true that anybody could stick a cassette in, and it's still true that you can stick a cassette in and broadcast and copy the FM signal. And I think it's about the same number of people who do each one of those things. I don't have proof of that, but it's very few people who go to the trouble of installing a software program that will specifically capture what's traveling through your sound card. We don't provide links to download programming. And without a link to provide, without a link to allow people, it's not that easy to figure it out. It's true, you can figure it out, but the number of people who will go to the trouble of figuring it out is tiny compared to the number of people who would download. And you can go further. You can go further than we have, where you would have to be a super hacker to do it. But as things stand right now, people can just get a piece of software such as Total Recorder that'll just record anything passing through their computer sound card. But people could also take the sound card. People could also take the headphone jack of their computer and stick it into their cassette deck. So I mean, you know, there's no way ultimately to prevent people from capturing your programming. The first question, how we know that the number of exclusive FM listeners, people who only listen to an FM signal and never listen to an online signal, is dropping, is because during our fundraisers, we don't accept pledges without the donor telling us how they're listening. It's one of the pieces of information that we require of every contribution, just like a zip code. We need to know whether they're listening to our one FM signal, our Catskills FM signal, or whether they're listening to an internet signal. We don't ask what kind of internet signal. We're not asking them, you know, which format. Are you listening to an archive or a podcast? Because there's too many possibilities. We just want to know how they're listening. And we give them the and another option is that they don't listen. And another option within our own internal database is unknown, that somehow they gave us money. Perhaps they just dropped a check off in the mail, and we just don't know how they listen. So we have five possibilities. And just based on the contributors, we're seeing that the number of online listening is going up. It's going up much slower than it was from 1997 to 2003. But the number of FM listeners is dropping faster and faster every year. And anecdotally, I'm in touch with a lot of community radio stations around the country and a lot of people around the country, a lot of other general managers and development directors who I've been in touch with, have mentioned that in the last 3 years they've seen a flattening or a drop-off of the number of contributors that they're getting. And we've seen the same thing at FMU. From 1997, the first full year that we really got into streaming in a big way, to 2003, we were seeing a huge increase in the number of contributors year upon year, 10% or more every year. It stopped in 2003. And since 2003, we've seen a flattening in terms of the numbers of contributors. And what's happening within our audience is that people are leaving the FM side and they're listening online instead. And I'm grateful, given all the competition that we face now, that we're not seeing a reduction in the number of listeners. I'm grateful, given everything that's going on and all the competition we have, from cell phones and cars to iPods to sites like YouTube and on and satellite radio and on and on and on. I'm just grateful that we're not seeing a drop off. But as much effort as we're putting in, you know, we're just seeing it keeping steady. A lot of other GMs and development people around the country are telling me that just in the last couple of years, they're seeing exactly what the bigger studies are showing, which is a drop-off in the number of listeners to public and community radio.
Okay, we got Lisa, we have Patty. Sandy has just asked to say something. We are right now 4 minutes away from the time we were scheduled to stop. We started at 10 minutes after we were scheduled to start, and I don't know if our trainers are amenable or the board is, but if they are amenable, is the board interested in taking back, say, 15 minutes from our break time during the day? We had an hour and a half of break time scheduled between the start of the training and the end of the training, in addition to an hour of dinner. Do we want to take back 15 minutes of that time to continue this discussion now? Okay, so then go ahead, Lisa. Then I have Patty, Sandy, and I'll just keep holding my tongue, if you can believe that.
I just have, I guess, a couple of comments. And one of the things that I see this as doing is kind of redefining what we mean when we say listening to radio and how we listen. Because before, when I first heard about listening to radio, I'm like, oh, please, give me a break. I'm online, you know, I'm online. But when you begin to see how the technologies can be integrated and you redefine listening, like, in my opinion, if somebody is not maybe listening to the box, but you can show that, well, gosh, they're online and they're utilizing, they're coming to the, you know, utilizing the stuff that the radio is offering online, to me, that's still a listener. So I guess it's depending on how you define that. And I've always said, or become to really see, not just with the youth, but you have a lot of people who, because they work, because they're outside a lot, they can't listen to the physical box. But when you come with creative ways, showing, because they're at work, and I'm one of those people, and you know, go all the time and visit certain kind of things, but to really, as people are talking about, really work toward integrating these technologies and getting people to understand. Because I got to tell you, when you talk about the archives and when people get emails about a certain person appearing on the show, you get that email online that you can go to the archives and can hear them. I remember one time, just a great surprise, but it worked so well, is when Minister Farrakhan was on, was interviewed, I think, on the Count on WBAI. And I happened to be online, their online newspaper, the final call, and right at the top of the paper, link, Minister Farrakhan, WBAI, you can go and hear it here. So that, to me, just helped to open my eyes even more. And I think that's what we have to redefine somewhat and challenge what we mean when we say people listening to the radio, and, you know, how we do that somewhat.
Patty?
I just wanted to...
Hang on, Mike. Is Patty's mic up?
Yeah, it's up here. Can you see? I just wanted to alert people, because I remember, Ken, during, and maybe people don't know, but during the time of when the foundation was in its takeover crisis, and WBAI took off Democracy Now!, WFMU ran it for at 6 o'clock for that whole many months. And I just wanted to acknowledge you for doing that.
Andy.
Rory's concerned about the dollars. I was wondering if you can give a thumbnail sketch of running a digital station as opposed to an FM broadcast station in terms of operational cost, and maybe comment on the startup cost for those of us without any facility.
Well, I mean, we started off practically for free. It was during the dot-com mania days, and, you know, we had companies that streamed us for free, and then just gradually over time we've started streaming our own stuff. At this point, we're spending a great deal of money on online transmission, probably about $300,000 a year for everything from hardware to personnel to bandwidth. But you can start off extremely cheaply. One of the downsides to starting off cheaply is that one of the ways you can control your costs is to put a limit. Through a company like Live365, you can put a limit on how many people can log on to your stream at a given time. I just think that you have to be careful about that, because you don't want to be bumping into that limit, because if you bump into that limit, it means that people are trying to listen to your station online and they can't get on. And I can't imagine that too many listeners would try too many times to get onto your station, find themselves locked out, and keep going back. So if you are going to put a limit of 20 simultaneous listeners, 50 simultaneous listeners, you have to really look at that and make sure that the first time you bump into that wall, that you raise the limit.
Quick follow-up. What is your limit?
We don't have a limit.
Thank you.
Can I just...
We don't have a limit just because we're streaming ourselves, and I'm buying bandwidth in bulk.
So I wanted to add, there's also important philanthropic resources available for making this type of program available for free. So Brewster Kahle's Internet Archive has committed to giving anybody who licenses content under Creative Commons free bandwidth, free storage forever. So It's not as high quality sometimes as the stuff that you would provide on your own, but to the extent you want a backup resource for making archives available, for example, that would be a perfectly free way to do it.
And to follow up on that, that site that Dr. Lessig just mentioned is the site where Amy Goodman moves listeners from the FM radio onto her podcast, and they provide the bandwidth and server space, as far as I know, gratis. And you'll note that when you go to the Democracy Now! Homepage, it says, listen, watch today's show, and you can download it, and Brewster Kahle pays the cost of that, or you can buy the CD at the same time. And people, as I understand it, do continue to buy the CDs even though it's available for download. And this dovetails nicely with what I was going to ask, because my personal feeling is that what Ken talked about what was the name of it? Perform? That's coming?
Perform Act.
Yeah, Perform Act. I think the history, if you look at what happened in radio, is that you expand an audience in an era of freedom, and then you have regulatory constrictions to commodify and capture the audiences that come there. And I think we're heading into that period. People may remember that Blue Ribbon campaign that everybody fought certain kinds of restrictions. I'm worried about the day when there'll be, you know, levies on bits and things like that. And I think, you know, Pacifica could position itself as a real, I think FMU's been a leader, but I think we can also develop some leadership in this area of saying, you know, we're going to do this in an open way. And the analogy I wanted to make was with open source software, which is, if you look at the production and distribution model of corporate software, Microsoft wiped out every corporate competitor. Every competitor that was using the same production and distribution model in the era of operating systems was wiped out. And a system that had very little in the way of assets, open source software, through a Commonwealth system was able to effectively compete. And the growth in that Commonwealth over time was exponential, so that now it's a serious competitor, whereas 10 or 15 years ago it wasn't. And I think what we decide to do in this area is going to be a really important thing, because I don't think any one institution can defend or fight the corporate media. I think we need a different production and distribution model so that civic media can defend it. And I think that if we show that we are willing to support the expansion of civic media, we'll get support from our communities. But we need revenue to build the infrastructure for a lot of this stuff. And so what I wanted to ask was, I don't think our existing listener sponsor model can generate the revenue to do the front end work that we need to do. And so one of the things I wanted to ask Dr. Lessig was, if we were to really take what we might think of as a visionary approach to supporting the growth of civic media, do you think that there are people, particularly people familiar with the open software approach, who might be willing to help fund the infrastructural development we would need to do this properly, as opposed to on a piecemeal basis, to really found a radical new civic media?
So let me respond first to the first part of what you said, and then answer the second question. There's a very important, very famous but important story about rates that internet radio have to pay to broadcast music across internet radio. As you know, to broadcast music across terrestrial radio, you don't have to pay the performers; you just have to pay for the underlying copyrights. But with digital broadcast, they created a requirement that internet radio has to pay the performance. So you first might think it's kind of bizarre that the established industry doesn't have to pay for something that the new industry has to pay for. But in the context of setting those rates, I was told this story, which I published in my book Free Culture, of how they were establishing what the rates would have to be that internet radio would pay. So the RIAA's expert was testifying about what they thought the rates should have to be. And one of the Real Audio lawyers responded after he testified and said, you know, that's an extraordinarily high rate. If you set that rate, we're not going to have 10,000 internet radio stations. We're just going to have about 10 or 15. And the guy explicitly said, yeah, that's what we think it ought to be. We don't think this market ought to have so many competitors. We think, you know, more manageable if we could just have 15 or 20 competitors, right? So it's explicitly deciding what the rate should be for the purpose of eliminating the diversity in speech that this medium otherwise begs for. And I think that, so that's exactly the point you're making. I do think, you know, so Creative Commons is in the business of raising funds in all in these markets, and so I can say I do think that there are important foundations that would be very interested in a program that was pushing the idea of civic media. And that program would be about modeling what it would be, how you're going to contribute to it, and also what infrastructure you need to get it going. So MacArthur has been a big supporter of this. And Hewlett, too, would be a big supporter of this.
You say big. What kind of numbers might be available for a project to really take a serious new tack in the area of making civic media really active and open in sort of analogous to what the open software movement has done?
Well, I have to beg off of answering that because I can't really speak for them about this. But they have contributed many multiples, millions of dollars to support the open content movement in general.
Could you repeat that one more time?
So if you aggregate the amount of money that the key foundations have contributed to support what we can think of as the open content movement, it's been many millions of dollars. You know, I'm not sure to the extent to which you could convince them to give a certain chunk to this particular corner of the open content movement. But I think Pacifica, of all the organizations that could take a lead in this, would be the most natural organization to try to enable that and get the support for that.
Okay.